we will have other committee members joining us shortly. Our chair, Senator Winters, is involved in other legislative business this afternoon. We have a format for presenting testimony this afternoon that will include two panels. We have the first panel including seniors and people with physical disabilities, which is the old SDSD program. And then at we'll take that piece during the first 45 minutes or so. And then following that, we will have another panel that includes testimony around developmental disabilities. I would like to call up now Jacqueline Zimmer Jones, and I understand that you have several people who will be with you following you. As a part of this panel. Oh, okay. Remind me of that.
Jennifer.
There is only one legislator here at this time, so if others will follow.
Please.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, Mr. Staff, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jacqueline Zimmer Jones, and I'm the director of the Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities, commonly known as O4AD. I don't see the pig out here today, so there's my one free acronym. And I am, like you, in the building every day, all day, so I am going to skip written testimony completely. You have in front of you a document that is from our association that does make reference to a number of programs that we provide, the Area Agencies on Aging provide, and you may read those at your leisure. Also today, we have handed out on a purple sheet of paper to you, and on that, I hope it's purple. At the top it says Medicaid and Oregon Project Independent Client Profiles with Corresponding Priority Levels, and I call that to your attention because the co-chairs and the governor's budget do call for the elimination of Oregon Project Independence in its entirety and a reduction in services, service levels 5, 10, 11, kind of depends on who you talk to. And so this is a client profile for you so that you can see sort of the types of folks that we're talking about reducing. I know today that the chair and other members of the committee really wanted consumers of our services to be the ones to do the talking today. That's another reason that I'm going to cut my comments short. But I must say, and I know this goes without saying, that if the people that we serve were the kind of folks that could get in their cars, drive down to the Capitol, navigate crossing the busy street, come up the stairs, come in the building, find their way around, and sit here to testify, then they really wouldn't be our consumers. And so there are five that we've brought here today that will be represent them as best they can, and those folks are not probably feeling at the top of their game today, but so they're anxious to testify and get on their way. So I will just let you know that there will be, following this panel here, a panel of clients and then a panel of advocates who do supportive and advocacy work for seniors and people with disabilities. So with that, I will turn it over to Janine Delaney with the Oregon Disabilities Commission, and if you have questions for me, I stand to take them anytime, or you can just contact me here in the building.
Thank you, and thank you for all of your hard work coordinating the testimony. And I'd also like to point out that Jennifer Wells is here from Committee Services. Jennifer, would you raise your hand? And she's here to assist us with public testimony. So if anyone has printed testimony that they want members of the committee to receive, please be sure that she gets it as your name is called forward.
Thank you.
Please continue.
Okay, my name is Janine Delaney, and I am the director of the Oregon Disabilities Commission. I know I'm one of the usual suspects that you didn't want to hear from, but again, like Jacqueline, I wanted to be here to say that we are the voice of people who can't be here, the people that are on GA, general assistance, the most frail of the frail, the poor folks that can't come to the Capitol, the people that were on the medically needy program that now maybe don't get their medications and are less able to participate in daily activities. The people in the mental health system that whose services have been severely impacted, who cannot be here today. And we are the voice for those people. And now our very voice is also being threatened as the co-chair's budget eliminates funding for the Disabilities Commission. So not only are we living in a time where the services are being drastically cut, the voice for these services is also being cut, or at least potentially being cut. And that's a critical value to have that voice at the legislature. Let me just say that in addition to general assistance in the medically needy program, which you've probably heard about many a time, the other issue that we're really concerned about is that there is now a cap on waivered services with seniors and people with disabilities. That means that they will only be able to take, I think it is, 4 new cases a month. So what happens to these people that need services? It seems to me like we're reinstitutionalizing all of the elderly and disabled, and I use those terms on purpose because I think if we categorize people and we put them in a group and then we put them in nursing homes because nursing home services aren't capped, sure, they're invisible and we won't see them, but it has an enormous cost, both in real dollars and in the values that Oregon stands for. And with that, I will let the consumers testify for themselves. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Don Butch from Newport, Oregon, and I'm the chair of the Governor's Commission on Senior Services. And I want to thank you for allowing me to testify before you today. I would like to spend today's testimony focusing on the impact of the cuts that have already taken place in the seniors and people with disabilities system and our growing concern for the future. Some of this will be repetitive, I'm afraid, from what Janine has said, because we do work hand in hand, whether we like it or not. Oregon's long-term care system is just that, a system that works together to provide cost-effective and quality services to Oregon's most frail seniors and most impaired people with disabilities. All parts of the system must be adequately funded and supported for the system to work well. I like to think of it as a four-legged stool, those in need, those who provide services, those who manage the system, and quality health care. In the ongoing debate over the 01-03 budget problems, the legislature took crushing cuts to the long-term care system. Unfortunately, the majority of these cuts were taken on the backs of seniors and people with disabilities. These cuts created a fundamental shift in Oregon's longstanding policy to provide services as early as necessary, thereby delaying more expensive care and preventing continued deterioration. The cuts that have been implemented do not mean that these people will never access services again. Rather, they will access services at a higher level of care, with more impairments and with a significant reduction in their quality of life. People without medications will become sicker. We have heard the stories, so we know this is true. Medications are the miracle of our age. People who would have died just 20 years ago live productive and fulfilling lives. Many of us seniors remember a time before antibiotics. Excuse me. Without medications for diabetes, heart conditions, epilepsy, and other chronic diseases, we are forcing people to return to what can only be termed the dark ages in healthcare. People without support systems, either in their own homes or in facilities, will also become more ill and more impaired. We have eliminated services for people who cannot bathe themselves, thereby increasing the likelihood of infection and diseases. We have eliminated services for people who cannot walk without help, thereby increasing the likelihood of falls and broken bones. We have eliminated services for people who need help with eating, thereby increasing the possibility of malnutrition, dehydration, and further impairments. And we have eliminated help for people who cannot use a restroom for their own. We have terrorized people, and we have torn people from facilities that were their homes. We appreciate the efforts the legislature went to restore some of the services to this needy population that will carry us through the remainder of this biennium. Even that humane act did not solve all the problems, do not relieve the anxiety of people facing cuts for critical services in just 2 months. The co-chair's budget would eliminate services to another level of clients needing long-term care services. It does not restore critical prescription drug coverage for those in need. It does not provide critical health care coverage for low-income individuals in our society, and does not provide adequate health care coverage for those who will still qualify. The governor's budget is not much better. We urge you not to make a conditional cuts to the system. Seniors and people with disabilities has already taken far more its fair share. We urge that you do the following. Restore the medically need program. Restore the long-term care services to people in levels 10 through 15, if not all the way to 17. Provide funding for senior mental health and addiction services. Remove the cap recently put on the home and community-based care waiver. Maintain provider rates at a level that will allow them to provide quality care, and fund Oregon Project Independence at a level that will ensure that those needing assistance can get it. Make sure that the Oregon Health Plan or its successor provides critical services to eligible populations, just as prescription drugs, durable medical equipment, dental and mental health, and addiction services. Currently, House Bill 3036 is pending that would give Oregon Project Independence a stable funding source without using general fund sources. We urge you to work with your colleagues to ensure that legislation passes. The future will judge us about how we handle this crisis. Will we be seen as leaders who can weather this difficulty, or will we be seen as those who destroyed a model system and turned our backs on those who needed our help? We urge you to find the funding necessary to restore services to those who need and to hold the line on any additional cuts. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Bush.
Madam Chair, this is going to take a second while we clear some chairs.
All right. The next panel includes Bernice Hopkins, Cleo Austin, Claudina Dilday, Robert Johnson, and Ruby Lawson. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Please.
My name is Bernice Hawkins, and I'm on disability. I'm 84 years old. I have, my occupation was nursing. I retired at 78. But I've always worked and took care of myself until now. Times have changed. I have congestive heart, angina, and high blood pressure, osteoporosis, and a fracture of 4 vertebrae. That's why I have to use a walker. And I have macular degeneration. And I'm sorry, but there's a lot of things that I didn't hear because I do have a very impaired hearing. So I appreciate all the help that I have had, and now I don't get any help at all with my medications. So some of the medications are going to have to go, I guess. But I thank you for the opportunity to speak to you. I thank you for the opportunity to meet you, and I appreciate any help that I can get. Thank you.
May I ask, what are the medications that you will not be able to afford?
Well, I have the acid reflux, which I take the Prilosec, which is very expensive. It's like $130-something for 30 pills. And I have the heart medication, I also have bronchial asthma, so I use inhaler, which is $101 each one. The heart medication is like, I can't pronounce it, so, but it's prescribed by Dr. Wasson Miller, and it's like $47 a month. So it all adds up to about $489 a month. So.
Thank you. That helps us better understand the situation that you're in.
Pardon?
That helps all of us better understand the situation that you're in. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I understand there's a lot of people that are having this problem.
Yes.
So I just hope you can manage to get the funds for us. And it's a blessing to be in America. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Thank you.
Hello, Madam Chairman. My name is Claudina Dilday. I'm 82 years old, and if this is cut any further, I'll be forced to move out on my own, which I cannot take care of myself. And if it is, I'll lose a lot more of my medication. And so I just don't know what I would do. I have nobody to live with if I'm kicked out. So I just don't know where I would go from here. I live at River Road Assisted Living in Kaiser. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
for being here, and thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Cleo Austin, and I'm 75 years old, and I get $566 a month to live on, and my medicine costs me about $180-some, and I can't afford to buy the medicine and live and exist. I have five forms of arthritis. I got migraine headaches thanks to a chiropractor, and I have, I'm nervous. I have a Lipitor for cholesterol, and the pea medicine that I have, I can't pronounce it, but the doctor put me on it because I have hardly no blood vessels in my feet and keeps my blood circulating. And if I get off of it, I'm afraid I'll get blood clots and die. I'm 75. Mm-hmm. I don't know what else I need to say.
Thank you. Thank you. Are there any questions or comments from the members?
Madam Chair, just a quick comment. You know, a lot of people feel that you have a high drug bill from taking dozens and dozens of drugs, but I think these ladies have illustrated you can have taking three or four medications and have a drug bill for $400 or $500 a month easily. And I'm assuming these are, you know, these are all Medicare recipients, but they have no pharmacy coverage. Mm-hmm. And that's where the Oregon Health Plan and the Medically Needy Program help these people so much.
Oh, I live by myself. I'm able to manage by myself, living rather. But I just can't pay for the medicine that I need.
Yes. I also feel a need to say something else to all of you. And I know that Representative Bates will probably join me in what I'm going to say next. It is regretful that we do not have all of our members present this afternoon to hear this testimony. We know how many of you struggle to be here so that we can hear, so that we could hear and understand. And so because some of our members are just unavoidably unable to be here, I just want to apologize on their behalf because I know that it appears disrespectful, and it feels disrespectful for our members not to be here and not to be hearing from people who've been so impacted and who have been left in such desperate situations. Representative Westland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a small word to Cleo and all the other witnesses that are going to come forward. Don't you worry just one little lick about being nervous up there. I mean, you're just sitting in a chair, and we are all just like the sons and daughters that I know you all have. So when you come up, just absolutely speak your mind as you have done from the heart, and that's exactly, you know, the best testimony that you can possibly have. So don't you or any of you be worried about coming up here and being nervous. We appreciate you being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate you having us.
Thank you, Representative Westland. Well said.
Madam Chair.
Representative Bates.
I just want to make a personal apology. I am going to leave in about 5 minutes for an hour, but I'll be right back as soon as that's over with. And I will read your testimony so that you're not wasting your efforts here. I've got a leadership meeting I have to go to and can't get out of. I'll be back as quickly as I can for the rest of the testimony, and I will read carefully whatever you submit to us.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Bates.
You can go. Thank you.
I believe you double check something if you can.
We didn't hear from you. Okay. The problems are opinion just right on. Let me finish reading. Trying to read the doctor's hand. Come on, give me a break. I mean, for you, you're doing pretty good.
When you finish reading, you can fill a prescription down.
Yeah.
Okay. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Robert Johnson. I'm one of those whose services are scheduled to be cut, I understand, unless the budget is restored. I worked all my life. I had my own paint company until, unfortunately, vision loss caused me to have to sell it. I'm totally blind in the right eye. I have shadow vision, or 2500 vision, left in the left eye. I'm extremely hearing impaired, and I have, I think the word is, neuropathy in my right leg and in my feet. Without the services that I get from senior services, somebody to come out and assist me in things like laundry, making the bed, making sure that the my socks are color coordinated, and I know which is my black slacks and which is my brown slacks. I can no longer distinguish dark colors. Green, blue, black, brown are all one color to me. At the present time, I do live independently thanks to the senior services being able to help me with, as I said, laundry and housekeeping and things. I am president of the Willamette chapter of the American Council of the Blind of Oregon. I am first vice president on the state board of the American Council of the Blind of Oregon. And I'm group leader for the Vision Northwest self-help support group for the blind. And I just feel that if my services, the services that I'm receiving are cut, that first of all, I will not be able to remain active in these groups, because I guess the next step would be down to some type of assisted living, which in the long run may be more expensive to the state of Oregon than the services I get now from senior services. It was mentioned before, some people with very expensive medications. Mine aren't quite that expensive, but I would really, really have a problem paying for especially the nerve damage medication that I take is quite expensive. It runs about $120 or something like that a month. And I really don't know what I would do if these services were cut. They do allow me to remain independent. And again, without that, I would probably be in some type of an assisted care facility. So I thank you for allowing me to come forward and talk to you today.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson.
I'm Ruby Lawson, and I've had a stroke, and I've got heart trouble, and I really need my housekeeper and my medicine. And my housekeeper helps me take a bath. She, in fact, I'm up on the third floor, and she gets my groceries and packs them up for me. And she does my vacuum and everything like that. And I couldn't do it without her help. I'd have to go to the rest home or assisted living. And my medicine is so high, and I am on a very low income. I only get $561 a month. And I appreciate the help I've got, and I just hope that you can get it situated so I can get help when I need it. Thank you.
And thank you. Thank you very much, Ms. Lawson. The next panel, I believe, includes Lucille Pugh, Lee Hazelwood, Ruth McEwen, and Mike Volpe. Please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm representing the Mid-Willamette Valley Senior Service Agency Advisory Council. I'm one of 23 members of this council, and we have councils throughout the state.
Could we have your name for the record?
Oh, please? I'm sorry. My name is Lucille Pugh.
Thank you, Mrs. Pugh.
And I'm not going to read the testimony, but I hope that you will read that, which kind of summarizes our council's feelings and beliefs about our system and about the people who are being served. I would like to tell you a couple of extra things that have come to mind as I have listened to the testimony of the people before me. I started work at a time when there was no system for seniors and people with disabilities. And I remember vividly the first time that I felt that there needed to be a better way to serve. And this occurred when a social worker came to me and said, "We have this older woman whose eyesight has become so deficient that she can no longer read or safely take her prescriptions. The only alternative that I can see is a nursing home placement." And I agreed with her, but I remember standing in the middle of the office and thinking that there must be a better way. And I'm pleased to say that over the years we have found better ways. No longer would this happen to this lady. There would be a way of assisting her to read those prescriptions and to safely have them allocated so that she could take them and still remain in her own home. I have seen great changes occur in our system of care for seniors and people with disabilities. And I think most of all, it's the fact that many people who would have been placed in nursing homes for lack of other kinds of care have been able to remain in their own homes or in situations where they have been able to remain independent, to do as much as they could for themselves. And I believe that that perhaps is the best reason for having the kinds of services and facilities and in-home care that we have developed. We do need nursing facilities. We need them for those who medically cannot provide for themselves. But I think experience bears out that once a person has someone do everything for them, they lose the desire or the energy to do for themselves. And our community-based services has really focused on that independence, the ability to thrive, the ability to do for oneself. And I suppose that as I see services cut back and look to the future, if there are further cutbacks, I see people becoming dependent, becoming less able to do for themselves, to have less energy, less ability to survive without expensive care in a nursing home, or perhaps some will require hospitalization. Recently, a client from Mid Willamette Valley fell and broke her hip as she was carrying in groceries. She happened to be one of the people who had been cut from service. She had previously had a caregiver who helped with shopping and carrying in her groceries. This is just one example of many. And the other point that I would like to make is that the workers in the field have been seen as people who were there to help. There is now a growing feeling among many of the clients when they are asked for an appointment or to come by, a fear that the worker is coming by to inform them that their service program is being cut. So we have lost, in a sense, the helping kind of thing that people perceived our staff as having, and as really a kind of fear that I'm going to lose my services. I really appreciate the opportunity of coming, and I hope that there are ways of restoring these critical services to older and disabled adults, that they can thrive and be independent and enjoy life. And I thank you for allowing me to come.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you.
My name is Ruth McEwen. Madam Chair and committee members, I thank you for the opportunity for letting me share with you what has happened to me since I've been cut off the medically needy program. I have a total income of $770 a month, and my prescription costs are $588 per month. Plus, on top of that, I have a Medicare supplement of $81 a month. So this doesn't set too good for me. And I've been in and met with several of the legislators with the Mid-Willamette Valley Advisory Council and talked about prescription. And they keep saying, well, there's the prescription programs out there for you. You can apply for those. Well, I knew this cut was coming, so I applied back in January, and this is being April. As of now, I have, out of the 11, I have received one result from that. Mm-hmm. So I'm still waiting to figure out on the other 10. And then I found out now that you have to reapply within 3 months. And you have to fill out the form. You have to get the doctor to fill the form out. Then you have to have a new prescription written by the doctor. Then it has to be mailed in. And you go through this process every 3 months. And many of our clients out there are not able to do this. And on top of that, it's going to be very hard for the doctors to keep up with all this paperwork. So I have a very concern there. And since I've been without the medication, some of my friends have taken up a collection and in the last month or so have been buying to me some of my medication because I was going having muscle twitching and having infections and problems. I'm still having problems from infections and the lesions because I have the systemic lupus. But I don't feel that my friends are going to be able to carry this burden the rest of their lives either. And so I feel that this is a very important issue that needs to be looked at by the legislature to find out ways that can be helped in providing for prescription coverage for people who do not have the insurance. And I'm not eligible for the Oregon Health Plan because I am on Medicare. And since this is blocked, then that leaves me no alternatives. So I'm just asking that you would look at this issue and see if there isn't some way to help people that are in critical need. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Mr. Hazelwood, would you like to go?
I'll let him go first.
All right.
Sorry,
Mr. Volpe?
Madam Chair, the rest of the committee, my name is Mike Volpe. I have had multiple sclerosis for 25 years, and in my case, it has been progressive from the time that I was diagnosed. When I was diagnosed, I could run, I could walk, and since then, it has taken its toll. I very much recognize the value of receiving my care in my own home, where I have been receiving care for 9.5 years. I did live in a nursing home very shortly and realized that living in my own home was far superior once I had the help that enabled me to do so. And now I'm very concerned about the programs that are being cut because the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare need to have certainty that the waiver program in Oregon will be sustained. And if the cuts continue to happen as they are now, I am very much worried that, yes, the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare will revoke the waiver that enables Oregon to have its long-term care program for community-based care. And so I am very concerned about that. Also, I am concerned about the durable medical equipment benefit which I receive, and the governor's and the co-chair's proposed budget for 2003-05 have not included that service for the people receiving who are on waiver services. And my wheelchair, which is brand new, costs me more than I get on my Social Security disability 2 years straight. And there's no way that I'd be able to afford that. So I would hope that you could find the revenue to try to stop bleeding. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Volpe. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I apologize. My testimony was...
Can I ask you, Mr. Hazelwood, to get closer to the microphone so that we can be sure to pick you up? Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Lee Hazelwood. I live in Staten, Oregon. I'm a longtime advocate for seniors and people with disabilities. I'm a member of the Mid-Willamette Valley Senior Service Agency Advisory Council. I'm also a former member of the Governor's Commission under the last three governors. Before I get to my testimony, and sorry about this, Madam Chair, but I do want to pay a compliment to your staff for helping me with a 58-year-old person who had some mental health problems, had almost 90-year-old parents, and your staff was able to help me. So I want to pay a compliment to your staff who helped me with that. I want to go on record to say that sometimes senators and representatives get blamed for certain things, but I want to pay a compliment to Sean for helping me with that. Over the years, I've represented Oregon at both the local and national level. I was a member of our state delegation to the 1995 White House Conference on Aging. In 96, I was elected a Silver Center to the National Silver Congress in Washington, D.C. In those two capacities, I've been coming together with hundreds of people around the United States. Without exception, those advocates wanted to know about the Oregon model, commonly known as to most of us as the Oregon miracle of long-term care. Other states have come to Oregon to find out how we did it. Some of them have even hired people away from our state agencies that help implement it in their states. Now this oft-respected and copied system, which has saved Oregon taxpayers over $500 million in long-term care, is slated for severe and probably drastic cuts. Those proposed cuts will hurt real people who are in desperate need and deserve our help. These are not just cuts. These are major surgery, the type of surgery that could lead to patients' deaths. All of you have probably heard from your constituents that our great system of long-term care is the best thing to come to Oregon since electricity. My son helped me with this, and I wanted to say sliced bread, but he overruled me. In fact, the system is a lawmaker's dream. What other program can give frail seniors and people with disabilities what they most value? Independence, choice, and the delivery of necessary assistance in their own home or home-like settings. Also fostered the creation of hundreds and hundreds of small businesses providing jobs around the state, while at the same time providing necessary services in the most cost-effective method. In 1997, Governor Bob Schraub said, "It is my opinion a disservice to place a man or woman in an institution when, with a little help, that person can remain in his or her own home and community. For many, the lifelong dream of dignity, comfort, and independence in retirement has become a nightmare of dread. Instead, there is a cruel tarnish on their golden years." That was 1973. In 1975, Governor Schraub signed into law the Oregon Project Independence, which is one of the greatest programs that other states would love to have. It's hard for me to believe that the 72nd Oregon Legislature and the governor want their epitaph to read, "We are the ones that helped dismantle the Oregon long-term care system." In our house are many books, some old and some new. Some were read once and some many times over. One of these books read many times over were written over 2,000 years ago. In that book it said, "Do not cast me away when I am old. Do not forsake me when my strength is gone. But as for me, I will always have hope. Even when I'm old and gray, do not forsake me." And that's Psalm 71. And I read that almost every week. Madam Chair, you and your committee have tough choices to make. But as I speak for many older Oregonians, I ask you, even though we are old and gray, do not forsake us. I thank you, and I'll be willing to answer any questions. But in the paperwork I gave you is a history of long-term care system. A lot of reading in that, and I apologize for that, but I thought some of you needed to have that. And I thank you for the opportunity to speak to you.
Thank you, and my apologies for being late. I was on other legislative business, and I just came in and caught the tail end of your comments, Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Ruth? You've heard from Ruth? Is it David? Dave? No, Dave Fuchs. Is that who's next? And Dave Parrott. You may begin.
Thank you, ma'am. Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to be before you. My name is David Fuchs. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of Cedars-Sinai Park, which is a multi-service campus to seniors in Portland. I'm also Legislative Chair of the Oregon Alliance of Senior and Health Services. Perhaps most importantly, I'm the son of a man who turns 87 tomorrow, and a woman who will turn 82 in July. And I am here representing today the Medicaid Long-Term Care Quality and Reimbursement Advisory Council, to which I've been appointed. This is a council that was created to provide advice to the Oregon Department of Human Services on Medicaid policy and quality issues. We in Oregon take great pleasure and pride in the diverse system of care that we've been able to create over the last 20 years. It, as you know, is an exemplar across the entire nation. And I have to say I'm particularly grateful also for the support of many of the members of this committee and legislative leaders, two seniors over the last couple of years. It has made an enormous difference as we've faced real challenges. The challenges we face today won't go away soon. As I'm sure you're already aware, the baby boomers are coming. In the next 10 years, we'll see a doubling of the level of demand for services to seniors, and that will probably double once again within 20 years. Our system is fragile. Nursing homes are now primarily used for short-term rehabilitation care, for late-stage Alzheimer's care, and to provide high levels of medical support for elders and people with disabilities who have no other recourse. Because of the diversity of other opportunities in our system, which we applaud, individuals coming into nursing homes frequently are coming in older, they're coming in with more complicated medical conditions, and they're coming in after having spent down what resources they have had, so that the safety net is providing the most expensive levels of care to people who have the least resource with which to participate in meeting their own costs, hence the dependence on Medicaid. There is today, under current rates, before any cuts would be implemented, on the average a $23 gap between what the state pays for Medicaid on a daily basis and what it costs to provide care. My own nursing facility, the Robeson Jewish Health Center, experiences about a $60 a day gap. We have a few different expenses like kosher foods, which add to our expenses, but $23 a day across the board for Oregon. We are concerned that even under today's circumstances, one of our rural providers in Tillamook County recently had to close its doors. Many of the facilities which are most fragile in our state are in rural communities, providing a critical service to individuals who would otherwise have to travel considerable distances to be able to meet their filial obligations. And it's noteworthy that many of these providers in rural communities are also among the larger employers in their communities. The proposed assisted living cuts would doubtless force a number of closures of assisted living facilities as well. The higher acuity of residents now in assisted living, the increased energy costs and liability insurance costs are already hammering that level of services. And it's critical that we maintain the capacity to provide Medicaid-level services to the population in assisted living. These services work. They make a difference in providing care to elders and people with disabilities with a greater efficiency and a lower cost than what nursing homes would provide. And as I'm sure you're aware, many of these facilities were funded with backing of the state housing department, and their closure brings challenges to the state in terms of its bond rating as well. Our foster care system is already in significant turmoil. Many foster families face challenges in managing without insurance, with increased energy costs, and the difficulty of finding or accessing respite caregivers. In fact, the representative of the foster care system on the Medicaid Long-Term Care Rates Advisory Council recently had to resign because she herself closed her business in the face of today's economic challenges. And finally, last but certainly not least, the in-home care system must be maintained. You've heard from many individuals whose circumstances are eloquent descriptions of the importance of that system. The fact is the majority of Oregon seniors and an even greater majority of Oregon citizens with disabilities are served by in-home care providers. Providing them with choice and dignity is of critical importance. Despite our challenges, today's system of care can be salvaged, can be protected. It can remain a viable national model. We have a continuum of care of services in Oregon in which we should take pride, and we need to keep in mind the enormous demand that will come at us. What we may allow to be destroyed in 1 year could take a generation to rebuild, and we need to be careful not to allow that to happen. We have a history in Oregon of pulling together and solving problems together. The people who came to this state didn't come here because they were rushing after gold. They came here although they knew it was going to be a harder life, to create a quality of life for themselves and for their children. I hope that we can keep faith with those pioneers and with their spirit as we look at the needs of our seniors. I have to share just a personal anecdote. I had an opportunity recently to be in the Middle East. And for the first time while I was in the Middle East, I had an opportunity to see a carob tree. It's a tree I'd never seen before. And the interesting thing I learned about a carob tree is that it doesn't bear fruit for 50 years. So that the people who plant orchards of carob trees are making a commitment, a vision, on behalf of the next generation. We here in Oregon are the recipients of the carob tree orchards planted by our parents, and it is up to us to plant that next orchard of carob trees for the next generation, and I urge you and beg you to do so. Thank you.
Mr. Parent, I'm going to send a message to the ones in C, because when you complete your testimony, then the citizens with people with disabilities will be coming on next, just so that they can hear me.
Okay.
Go ahead, Mr. Parent.
Madam Chair Winters and members of the committee, I want to thank you today for the opportunity to be before you here. I am David Parent. I'm the Executive Director of Dallas Retirement Village and also member of the Oregon Alliance, the Senior and Health Services Legislative Committee.
And Mr. Parent, you've given us written testimony, and it would be helpful if you could summarize for us, and then they can read all the details.
I would be happy to.
Thank you.
Okay. First of all, I do want to share with you and want to thank you for your past support over the last biennium in restoring some of the funding cuts that were proposed. I think, as all of you understand, and we do too, that the proposed cuts would have been devastating to each of us in this industry. I ask certainly that you will look to this next biennium and to give us, again, that additional support we will need to be able to make it through that period. As you understand, we are certainly at the beginning and a time when the senior population is growing, and we certainly, as David has very eloquently said, we need to make sure that we have a system in place that will continue to be in place over the next 10, 20, or 30 years. Dallas Retirement Village is a not-for-profit company in Dallas, Oregon, started in 1947 by the Mennonite Church, and we have been providing care to the seniors in our community. We are because, as David said, we have residents there that have outlived their resources who are dependent upon us in the state to assist them and make sure that they have adequate funding and adequate care. We come to you today because we feel that this is certainly a very important step that we need to take to make sure that the funding is restored or maintained at the current levels. And as we have already stated to you, actually those levels are not adequate, certainly even what our needs are today. We would like to see and would love to be able to see an opportunity to additionally add levels to that, but certainly our greatest concern is we cannot sustain a cut in our current Medicaid levels that are both for the nursing home and also for assisted living. I can give you examples, and certainly you have them before you here, of many residents that have been in our care and also care of our other senior communities, and because of time, I certainly won't go through all of that, but suffice to say, these individuals need the care there. When that care has been cut, when they've had to move out, each individual over and over again have suffered and in many cases come back to us at a higher level of care and a higher cost to both them personally and also to the state. And so certainly we understand that we're in a very difficult time budget-wise, but as we have to understand also, this is an investment not only to individuals but also in our own system, because we do not always save money by being short-sighted in sometimes providing care that will keep people and sustain people at an appropriate level. Let me just close, and again to reiterate that the need in our community is great. Our costs continue to rise. We understand that these are difficult times, and I think as an association and individual, I'm willing to work with the state in trying to come up with creative ways and ways that we can partnership and look to maintain the appropriate level in our homes. And I look forward to doing that with you in the coming weeks.
Thank you for your testimony. And any creative ideas that you have are certainly welcome. I look forward to working with any of you who will help us in this in crafting solutions to this very, very difficult budget. And I appreciate your testimony. Thank you, David and Dave.
Thank you. All right, thank you.
Catherine, are you ready?
Jane testified. Branham. He did not. No. No.
Ellen.
Ellen has not.
And Mark. Yes. These are all of Catherine's
lists. And these are not, I don't think.
This guy is our guy that comes up here. He's the guy in the green shirt.
Wow.
He's the guy in the green shirt. No, you're fine. You're fine. I just want to know if you had all of your people.
No, our people haven't started.
Okay.
And then I think I crossed them off. One of these guys. These guys. I got it. All right.
The next time the governor asks me to put faith in my school, I'm going to tell him no.
Which temporarily is executive
director? He says he's going to have governor.
Don't let him die. All right.
Where are the Smith? What are they doing?
Are you ready, Catherine?
Okay.
Cool stuff. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Catherine White, and I'm with the Oregon Developmental Disabilities Coalition, which is a coalition of organizations that include providers, families, and individuals with developmental disabilities and other advocacy organizations. I've handed out a fact sheet that tells you what a developmental disability is, and what we wanted to do was just stress the fact that a developmental disability often starts at birth and is an entire lifetime of disability, and the services that we are going to be talking about today span the lifespan, often starting at birth. Our purpose today is to help you get a sense of who are the individuals that receive the services, what those services are, and some of the challenges that are facing us. We've scheduled our structured testimony in basically three panels to represent the continuum of services. One is, and we're going to start with services that are provided to family members, of children under the ages of 18. We'll talk a little bit about adult support services, and those are the services that are provided under the Staley Settlement Agreement. And then we will have a brief panel of providers who will talk about the services that are provided in comprehensive services in the residential system. Thank you.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Jean Mendenhall, and I'm from Bend, Oregon. I've worked in Deschutes County for the past 11 years as the family support specialist. The premise of this approach, I believe, is innovative, it's proactive, and it's cost-saving. Family support assists families. They do not enable them. We strive to establish positive relationships which fosters a trust that's built and allows us to then build on the family's natural supports. We then formalize an individual plan for each family. We identify issues that are stressors to the family. We look at what options and brainstorm what possibilities we can to alleviate those problems. We look for other resources that might be available. And then we help them put those supports in place of which are helpful to the family. I have found that families then feel more in control of their situation, and they're empowered when difficult situations arise. They often do not look for support outside. Spending a small amount with families at this point, I know, keeps them out of crisis. We have submitted some written testimony from families that I'd like you to look over. And I believe that after hearing them, you'll understand that these families without this support will be looking for out-of-home placements. Thank you very much.
Hello. My name is Sandy Hillebrand. My picture, my family just got circulated around. My husband, yeah, that's me. My husband is Rob, and we have three children. Gabriel's 6, Silas is 3, and Eve is 3 months old. And Gabriel has autism. One evening, about 7 months after he was diagnosed, I was getting him out of the bathtub, and he screamed in my ear, and I slapped him. I had gained 45 pounds since Silas was born, and Gabriel's behavior ruined every positive, connecting, building experience we attempted as a family. Finger painting, Da Vinci days, the zoo, to name only a few, were completely overwhelming to him because his senses are out of whack. Many think of autism as a child that withdraws or that does their own thing and can easily be invisible or forgotten. Among my friends who have children with autism, there are daily maddening situations that, because he's our first child, I don't even know how to describe. It's like asking a fish to describe water. It's part of life. It's all, when he was about 18 months old and people would do things like close a door if he was in the room, Rob and I would look at each other like, don't you know not to do that? What's the matter with you? You have kids, because we don't know the difference between kids that do and don't. He, to get anything yucky on his hands is like having a bone broken or something. For him, his senses tell him he's in danger when he's not. He is adored by his early intervention preschool teacher at that time. He was 3 at that time. And by his church teacher in Sunday school. And this added a disenfranchised element to the grief that in many ways was the heaviest part of the burden. He is a beautiful child, you can see, and isn't in a wheelchair. It's not an obvious disability. He can only hold it together for so long. And I was beginning to see that I could not hold it together for much longer. For example, if he came in twirling a stick and said, is it going pretty fast or real fast? And I answered wrong, it could begin a series of meltdowns that would take all evening to recover from. He functions in codes that Rob and I know now pretty well. For example, if the wooden spoon's in his right hand, you can safely say really fast because he's right-handed and he can twirl it faster. He thinks that we are as into these studies in speed spinning as he is. He feels understood. He's happy. He doesn't know we know he's right-handed and that we figured out how to get around this because we don't understand why spinning is so interesting, but it works. For this reason, a babysitter would never work. It would take somebody who knows the code. When I slapped him that evening, getting out of the bathtub, I wasn't immediately filled with remorse, like you might imagine someone who'd experienced a weak moment. I was angry at the fit that I knew would come. I remember when I was about 6, my mom slapping me once. Very vaguely remember it. But what I vividly remember was her falling apart immediately afterwards and her apology. And how it was out of character for everything I knew about her and my relationship with her, and very easy to recover from. This wasn't like that. I honest to God in my heart believed that my action was self-defense, that this 3-year-old could kill me, could smother me, and that I was trapped. It was a grim, though this was an isolated incident, it was a grim representation of our life then. Our respite provider, Felicia, is an adult with a lot of experience. She's in college and has a lot of energy. My kids love her. I love her. If this experience doesn't convince her to tie her tubes, it will immensely contribute to her capability as a parent and as a community member. I can now feel the love that I always had for my son. we like each other, and our spiral is now upward instead of downward. And we do still have some tough times, but that's all they are, and they don't carry the threat that they used to carry. Gabriel didn't ask to have autism, and Rob and I didn't ask for this challenge. And it influences our other children as well. My three-year-old goes to public places with a whole other idea of what's important and how people interact than his peers do. It's important to include here that while my situation leaves me completely saturated, it is not the worst-case scenario that's out there. There are many families who have it much worse. Respite is cheap. It's the circuit breaker that keeps the house from burning down and the neighborhood from catching fire. Felicia costs $8 an hour. I don't know of any counselors or penitentiaries or institutions for the developmentally disabled or foster care situations that are anything like that cheap. With a little fresh air, my family can do for Gabriel and for each other what none of these expensive agencies can do. I hope my remarks are helpful in the difficult decisions that you have to make. Thank you very much for your hard work.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Helene Tolliver, and this is my daughter, Danielle, and we're here today to share with you what the services we receive from the Family Support Developmental Disabilities Program in our community mean to our family. Danielle is a beautiful, happy 10-year-old girl that has the social and activity level that is typical of any 10-year-old. However, her acquired cerebral palsy makes her rely on someone for assistance with every aspect of her life: playing, eating, toileting, repositioning, and making sure that she's kept safe. Her constant care starts at 3:30 in the morning when we have to give her medication, and the end of the day for her constant care is at 10 o'clock at night when her final feeding is done. And we have to sometimes during the night get up if she makes herself unsafe by her reflux or by biting herself unknown to her. Her physical limitations and medical issues consists of changing her pants because she's incontinent, feeding herself. She loves to eat, but she's unable to move her arms to self-feed, and is fed via a G-tube because she's not a safe swallower. She requires 24-hour monitoring because of her reflux, her seizures, and repositioning to help prevent skin breakdown every few hours. The services and programs that we're associated with in the community classify her as medically fragile, profoundly involved, and a host of other medical labels. However, our family does not receive Medicaid, and she does not qualify for the medically fragile program, and we unfortunately do not have the financial means to take care of her needs. We receive respite through the county family support program, and with the hours that we receive, we're able to have someone do her bathing and her feeding, work with her on her therapy programs, and take her out into the community to give her the social interaction that she needs. The other time that we use is used for ourselves. It helps us unwind from the continual stress that we reach because of her constant needs, and it helps us as a couple bond more, and it gives our son a chance to get some of the time that he has to sacrifice because of her needs. That is why the funding is crucial to our family, and without it, I don't know what we would do. Thank you for your time.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Chris Thomas, and I'm from Portland, Oregon. This is my son, Eric, and Eric would like to say just a couple of things, and I will be interpreting for him since the microphone won't reach.
As she said, my name is Eric Thomas.
My name is Eric Thomas.
And I am 18.
I am 18. I live in Portland.
And I am a senior at Southridge High School.
And I am a senior at Southridge High School.
And I just want to say I think that's been fun to me. Is very, very, very important.
And I just want to say that staying at home to me is very, very, very important.
Well, what did you mean to me and other kids like me?
To me and to other kids like me. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thomas, did Eric come and visit us once before?
Twice before.
Yeah, I remembered you when you came and testified.
Yeah.
I'm glad you're doing well.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and committee members, I'm Bill Ullman, Executive Director of Eastern Oregon Support Services Brokerage, one of the 10 support service brokerages in Oregon. We provide supports to people with developmental disabilities living in their own homes or in the homes of their families in 13 Eastern Oregon counties, from Hood River and Wasco County in the northeast to Harney and Malheur County in the southeast. We're a private, not-for-profit membership organization. Our customers, that is the people with developmental disabilities that we support, elect our board of directors and provide policy oversight to brokerage staff. Most brokerages have similar kinds of organizational structures where our customers are our bosses. Brokerages in Oregon are built on the philosophy of self-directed support, which is a relatively new concept. In the past, people with developmental disabilities were treated as if they were incapable and needed to be taken care of. In fact, with support, the majority are capable and they can make their own decisions about their lives. Families and other people close to them are often an important source of the support that they need in order to make their own decision. The overarching goal of support services brokerages is to assist people with developmental disabilities and their families to achieve true choice and control of the supports and resources that are available to them. This goal is grounded in a concept called self-determination, a concept built on the fundamental belief that if people gain control of their supports and resources, their lives will improve and costs will decrease. Self-determination is the freedom to plan a life with support, the authority to control those support dollars, and the support to be involved in the community, and, of course, the responsibility to be a community member who's fiscally responsible in using public funds. The supports that brokerages provide can come in many forms and happen in many places. People with developmental disabilities can receive support at work, in their community, in their home. Examples of the supports that people receive are job training and retention skills, help with budgeting, meal planning, bus passes to get out in the community, respite care, adaptive appliances, installing ramps, grab bars, and augmentative communication devices. I have some stories and letters from people all over Oregon to share with you. In addition to those, I would like to share the stories of two people who have given me permission to describe their needs and their services. Thank you. First, Maria. Maria lives in Burns, Oregon, way down in Harney County. She lives with her mother and her younger brothers. Her mom provides nearly full-time care for her. Maria has developmental disabilities, including moderate cerebral palsy, controlled seizures. She uses sign language to communicate. She uses a wheelchair to get around. She's 28 years old, and she has a younger brother with autism. Maria qualifies for services above our base benefit level, which means she needs a lot of services, and we've gone through an evaluation process to be sure that those are appropriate. Because her mom has to stay home and take care of her needs, she receives about 20 hours a month in pay to provide direct care to Maria, Maria's mom can't work outside the home because of Maria's needs. She also receives 5 hours a week of respite care so she can have a break from the constant demands of taking care of her daughter. Maria has been able to hire a service provider to take her into the community and learn the kinds of social skills that she needs to function on her own in the community. She and her mother have gotten handrails installed to assist her in getting around her apartment. They've been able to get her wheelchair repaired so that she can get around the community. She receives physical therapy monthly and a posterior walker to assist her with her posture and the proper alignment of her spine. We've also arranged for Maria and her family to learn sign language to better communicate with Maria. We were able to arrange for her to obtain a three-wheeled bicycle so that she can pedal around the neighborhood, the apartment complex, with her brothers. Not all of these supports were paid for with support services funds that are matched by general fund dollars. A lot of these were paid for by other sources that were arranged by our personal agents on behalf of Maria and her family. Now let me describe Norris. Norris lives in Ontario with his mother. I picked people down south because you folks don't get to see these folks. You get to see a lot of folks from around here. These are the people you probably don't get much of a chance to see. Norris moved off from Fairview Training Center to a foster home and then to his family home. He's been home for 11 years. He has developmental disabilities. He's blind, and his mother provides complete assistance with eating, with toileting, and with bathing. He needs constant supervision and support. He's 47 years old. He had a heart attack 4 years ago, but his health's really getting pretty good now. He doesn't like to get shots, and even though he's blind, he can smell when he's going to the doctors, and it makes him yell. A lot of things make him yell, though. Strangers, being startled, dogs, changes in his routine. He loves country music. He loves parties. He loves dancing. And he loves his day program at Whitco, and he loves routine. He speaks in one-word sentences. Besides his mom, he's got a sister and her family and a niece's family who are his primary support group, so he's got very strong family in the Ontario area. He receives enough support to attend a day program at Whitco, about 20 hours a week. He likes to shred paper, and he makes about $40 a month shredding confidential documents at Whitco. He receives personal care services, assistance in bathing, toileting, and mobility. And because he needs constant supervision, his mom gets a break when a caregiver takes him to different places in the community to visit other family members. Although he does have this tendency to yell in public, some of his visits to the community are kind of short. Norris's needs are great, and he receives in the community from his family supports that really approximate the same level of supports that are provided in the very expensive comprehensive service system. But because his family provides most of those supports, with the brokerage providing support so that they can handle it, he really receives supports at a much lower funding level than he would ever receive in the comprehensive service system. You want to hear first?
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Kristen Ahrens, and I work for Self-Determination Resources, which is a brokerage that serves Washington County. And SDRI, the company I work for, is the pilot project for the state of Oregon to help develop brokerages, and we've been in existence for a little over 5 years. We've spent 5 years helping try to change this service system, and we believe that ultimately the change in the service system will change public perception of people with disabilities, and it will change our communities ultimately. We operate on a couple of premises. One, that if people control their supports, then their lives will improve and costs will decrease. Two, that if people shouldn't have to make the choice to place a family member in a facility because they can't provide the support at home. And I want to speak to a couple of issues around finances and brokerages. And one is the cost-effectiveness issue, and I'd just like to talk about a few different examples where I think you can see the cost-effectiveness of this type of service system. One is sort of the more immediate cost-effectiveness. There's every day that we support somebody to continue living at home, we're not paying for it in the comprehensive service system, which is much more expensive. And an example was a young man that I work with that he was in a comprehensive home for a short period of time at the cost of about $8,000 a month. We have served him. I've worked with him for 5 years. This last year, his total cost for the year were about $5,600. This year, they'll probably be about $800 a year. And that's a combination of in-home support, somebody helping him to get ready in the morning, and some behavior consultation. So every day we help with proactive planning and keeping people at home. That's more dollars saved.
Are you keeping your statistics? And the program is relatively new, so I know that the data is not comprehensive data, but are you required to keep on an ongoing basis the success and the outcomes and what's occurring with the individuals that you provide brokerage services for?
We have real extensive data on the customers that we're serving now and the costs of their supports and what types of supports. We do also track who goes into comprehensive services and why.
And are you providing that information to the state agency?
We are. Yeah.
Thank you.
If we look at some of the long-term planning, I'll talk a little bit about Mallory Parkin, who's here with her mother, Lori Parkin. And this is one example of the type of service that happens when you're looking at long-term care and long-term planning. Mallory lives in a home that's incredibly inaccessible. It makes for horribly dangerous transfers. Her mother has injured her back multiple times, can't do the transfers all the time. When Mallory graduates from high school, unless we figure out a way to get a place for her equipment in her home, she would no longer be getting any of the therapies that she requires. So over the last 3 years, we have worked very intensively together and have I think, I'm going to knock on wood because they're picking out paint, but the ground hasn't been broken. We're putting an addition to the home that will include an accessible bathroom and a living space that will not only be separate so Mallory can live as an adult separate from her sister. She shares a room right now. But she would have a place to do those therapies for her caregivers to come in and an accessible bathroom that's not dangerous to do transfers in with the roll-in shower. The total cost of this project was the initial bids we had were from about $54,000 to $84,000. The cost to this program is going to be $3,700. We've pulled together a huge variety of community resources, people donating labor, materials, family taking out a low-cost loan. And the support to Mallory over the last year was about $10,000 to have a caregiver coming in and doing baths and evening transfers. And this year it'll probably be about $14,000. Versus Mallory requires nursing care, and I'm guessing a minimum of $3,000 a month if she were in a group home or a foster care. So huge, huge savings when we're able to pull together a support plan like this. Some other areas where you see savings on a long term, think about things like Oregon Health Plan. I've got two examples. I've got a young woman who we've spent a couple $100 on an autism consultant to come help her family understand some autism and develop a training program for her bowel and bladder care because she wears some very expensive pull-ups, which are paid for by Oregon Health Plan. They're around $1 a piece. She was wearing them every day, all day. And right now she is down to wearing them when she menstruates. This is probably a cost of about $100 a month savings to the Oregon Health Plan because of a couple $100 training with her family. Another situation is another woman that I work with who was recently diagnosed with borderline diabetes and lives on her own, and I think without the support, she's probably someone who would be having some very expensive treatment and medication down the road, again, picked up by Oregon Health Plan. And we're providing some skills training to help her make good choices at the grocery store and develop an exercise program for herself so that hopefully that day doesn't come. On the systems level, another savings, and this is basing this on the model budgets. I was also part of the Universal Access Planning Committee back when this program was being designed. The cost change between when you're shifting duties from a county case manager from county government doing some of the duties that we do at the brokerages, there was a significant savings. The PAs at the brokerages, the model budgets were about $46,000 a year per PA, and when the county DD managers were talking, they were talking that their per case manager it was between $80,000 and $90,000 a year for case manager. the other area where I think you really see some cost effectiveness that'll come out of this program over time is that we really beat the bushes for other resources and tried to make partners out of some other local resources that I think people with developmental disabilities haven't been able to effectively use over time. We pull together voc rehab and schools, and we all sit down and do plans together so that all of those dollars are being spent in a way that are going to have an impact in the future. The other piece I want to touch on really briefly is the issue of the underspending of our plans. The average is budgeted at $800 a month per person, and the costs are coming in at closer to $500. And I just want to say that the underspending, we've seen this with the family support program, is a result of two things, I think. One is that still a new program, and people coming in, we are still in very early stages of planning with people. I mean, I've worked with Mallory for 5 years. That was a three-year process to pull together her plan. And that's going to happen in a new program. The other piece is that I think we've overwhelmed our communities and we've overwhelmed providers. There aren't enough providers to provide the services that we're looking for. And we're running ads and recruiting all the time, but we still have lots of people who don't have the services they need. So, Lori.
Hi, I'm Lori Parkin. This is my daughter, Mallory. Mallory's 19. And Mallory very easily could be put into a home if I'm not able to take care of her. I'm her complete caregiver. We do have somebody that comes into the home to bathe her and do a lot of lifting since I have hurt my back so many times. Our house is very small, and Mallory may not be that big, but she's pretty long. And you can hit her into the walls very easily trying to get around her room and into the bathroom. So we have come together, and we are hoping to have this addition built so that I can keep Mallory at home. If Mallory was in a position where she would have to be put into a home and leave me, I would just die. I have four other girls, and Mallory and I are so closely connected. I can read her like a book. And she would not be able to go on without me either. So I really, really need to have her with me. She needs to be there. I can't stress that anymore. She has been able to receive, you know, support dollars. She has been able to go out into the community with a peer, which is very important, being 19 years old, to go into Portland, to go shopping, to do anything that are just, you know, basic normal things that teenagers do. And we would not have been able to do that without the support dollars. Very, very important. And I just thank you.
Thank you.
We provided these stories to put a face on the needs and services that are typical of the people that brokerages support. The question we all have to ask is, what will happen to these individuals if your supports are not there?
If you have your testimony in writing, I would ask you to give it.
Can.
We have it,
right.
Because we need to get to your next group.
Yeah. We'll go.
And I would ask you, if you have written testimony, please summarize for us.
Hello, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jean Farr, and we appreciate very much being able to come and present before you. I will begin the testimony by giving a brief overview of the community service provider system, and then my colleagues Sheila Barber and Daryl Wilson will talk about the issues facing them, and we'll conclude with testimony that I will give from our organization's perspective. There are currently about 110 organizations across the state providing a variety of services to about 5,000 people. These services include housing, mainly in the form of group homes, employment, and day supports. Most of these organizations are nonprofit and have been in their community for 20 or more years. In many of the rural or smaller communities, the DD provider is one of the larger employers in that community. The major challenges facing our population are the increasing costs and the declining public funding, workforce recruitment and retention, and the changing needs of the people that we support in these organizations, because there's no sort of attached funding mechanism to be able to address those needs. So now I will turn it over to Sheila to speak for a couple minutes.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. My name is Sheila Barker, and I'm here representing the Community Providers Association of Oregon. CPAO is a professional association of residential and employment providers, and we assist at least...
Ms. Barker, excuse me, could you pull that microphone closer to you? We want to be sure to hear you. Thank you. Thank you very much.
We assist at least 400 persons with developmental disabilities or mental health needs. And we do have a few people in the audience from our group today. Usually our public testimony focuses on the needs of our clients, but today we're going to be a little bit out of character. We also, if we don't talk about our clients, we talk about the needs of our staff, and we'll be touching on them a little bit too, but today my job is to give you a clear picture of the squeeze on those of us who provide the services for these clients, so you'll have a more complete understanding of how things look from our perspective. You have some handouts that look like this. Mm-hmm. So I'll be referring to those as I go through the testimony. These are tough times for all Oregonians. Our businesses face many of the same challenges as any other in this economy. There are costs that are rapidly eating away at our ability to provide quality services. On the second graph that you have in your packet, it talks about the insurance costs that we've experienced at Spruce Villa. For the past 2 years, our insurance has jumped $20,000 a year. Most of that is workers' compensation and liability, although we are getting inflated prices in auto, home, and flood insurance, just like the rest of society. My apology, go back to the first graph. And you'll see that our utility costs are going up too. But the major point of that first graph that you have talks about food costs. There are very few places in our budget where we have some discretion as to how we spend our money and what we can buy. So the graph does show that we have a declining cost in food. That doesn't mean we're starving our clients, but they are getting their meals. But it's one place where we can find some savings. On the third graph that you have, we start looking at turnover. You would think that with an unemployment rate of 7.3%, we would have people clamoring for jobs. But the reality is our workforce falls into highly skilled workers and low-wage workers. The highly skilled include our registered nurses, where there is a massive shortage, and what we can offer them in wages is below market. The fourth graph shows you one thing we're proud of. We've been able to raise wages, partly with your assistance. You've voted in the past to increase wages for our workers. But if you then look at the last graph, you'll see that while the increases have happened, they're slowing over time, and the cost of living index has not slowed. So now people are making less money than essentially they did before. It is very hard to find. The work that we do is very hard. And a lot of the people that are out there aren't willing to work that hard for $9 an hour. So at the wages we offer, it's very hard to attract and keep quality people, even in this economy. There's a big difference between our industry and others. We can't raise our prices. Like skilled nursing facilities or other kinds of 24-hour client services, we have no fee-for-service clients. There's no long-term private insurance for developmentally disabled. and they can't save up or earn a living. Almost 100% of the revenue that we have comes from the state or other governmental sources. In the face of rapidly rising costs, unfortunately, the state cut our 2002-2003 cost of living adjustment. That was going to go for wages. So far, the governor's budget and the co-chair's budget have not included a COLA for the next biennium. So what is the impact? Well, some providers of residential care are going to be driven out of business. One can say that this is just a fact of the marketplace, but in our case, where will these folks go? It is truly hard to imagine growth from other providers to pick up these clients. We are at a point where we can't always afford to meet the needs of some of the folks that we're providing services for. And since our clients are getting older and our providers or our facilities are older, the costs of both increase over time. When a provider goes under, these individuals increasingly have no place to go. And I'm not trying to be overdramatic. I know you are all between a rock and a hard place, but you need to know what's happening out here. I do support the community model that the state created to facilitate the closure of Fairview. I'm a part of that model. It launched many not-for-profit businesses like my own, and it provides opportunities for our clients that had been out of reach. But if the legislature cripples the service provider industry, it will have done these folks a disservice by making it more likely that they will lose their homes than if they were under the state's direct care. Please don't make more holes in the safety net, because we will all fall through. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so very much, members of the committee and Chairman Winters, for the opportunity to testify before you today. I am Darrell Wilson, Executive Director of the Opportunity Foundation of Central Oregon, commonly known as OFCO. OFCO provides a broad range of employment and assisted living supports to about 128 persons who live in Crook, Deschutes, and Jefferson counties. Most of these people have developmental disabilities, and we also serve persons who have other disabilities such as visual or physical challenges. Over the years, Representative Westland has visited our programs, and he has also spoken to our board of directors. He has personally seen our byline, possibilities, not disabilities, at work in Central Oregon, giving people with disabilities the opportunity to be productive, contributing, and responsible members of their community. Speaking of work, this is a very difficult time for many Oregonians. There's a terrible collision of public need with drastically declining public resources. Persons with disabilities have felt this very directly in many different ways. Likewise, my company is struggling to stay solvent and continue its mission of supporting persons with disabilities. Why? Let's take revenues first. There's been no COLA for the past fiscal year to address the inevitable and multiple increases in the cost of doing business. Additionally, client fees for services have stayed flat, though in many cases their needs are rapidly increasing due to age-related medical issues. Additionally, in 1 year, five residents of our group homes have passed away, and their replacements were funded at much lower rates. We also lost the Vocational Rehabilitation Sheltered Services Program due to cuts in the last biennium. Our vocational rates, which are mainly based upon when OFCO began providing vocational services, are in the bottom third of the overall state ranking. We have a wood mill that produces secondary wood products, and its sales are down by 40% due to the decline in the economy. Sales in the wood mill used to subsidize other parts of our operation that ran at a loss, but now the mill is at a loss. But in a nutshell, OFCO has a crisis on the revenue side of our business. To add insult to injury, the costs of doing business have been leaping out of control. In the past 5 years, safe premiums, FICA, medical, dental, and related costs have more than doubled. With the low wages of our industry, we try to compete in the labor market by providing very good benefits. But now we're increasing deductibles, co-pays, dropping coverages, and requiring more employee contributions. And with wages just a little above minimum wage, our employees are hard-pressed to take on this burden. Many have taken second jobs, and some have dropped their coverages. Other forms of insurance are also out of control. Property, fire, general liability, vehicle insurance is going up 25% this year. Energy, natural gas, electricity, gasoline have also been on an upward tear. What's the bottom line? Last year, OFCO ended its fiscal year with more than $115,000 in the red. That's in the hole. And that's a crisis that really threatens us. And I got to say, my organization is not alone. Many, if not most, of programs like us are facing similar financial struggles. So what happened? As a result, we let 42 staff people go compared within the first 6 months of this fiscal year to the first 6 months of last fiscal year. Did it affect services to people with disabilities? You bet. We had to curtail services in every area. We had to retrench a great deal, and it was really tough to do. We still have a great staff, although some of the best have moved on to jobs with better security and, in some cases, better pay. We still provide good services, but my industry is on the brink of financial disaster, and the persons we serve and their families have a profound sense of vulnerability and threat. To close, remember OFCO's byline, possibilities, not disabilities? Somewhere in the future of our wonderful state is the possibility that the most needy and the most vulnerable in our state will live with the security that their homes and employment supports are safe, that their medications that they need to be healthy will be there, and that the staff to assure their safety and well-being will be with them as well. We're far from that vision right now. Getting there will require major changes. To accomplish this vision, we need your support. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you for coming and offering your testimony. If Bob Costanza, I believe, is, and Ellen Lowe, if you hear me, and Jerry Smith, I'll have Bob and Ellen, and then Jerry, you will follow them. Gene, did I miss you?
You did.
Well, I'm sorry.
Would it be okay with you if I went ahead with my testimony?
Yes, I'm sorry. I thought you had done while I was out, and I was going to tell Chris hello for me when you went back to Portland.
Yeah, no. Again, for the record.
And I have to say this. For those who know, I really apologize because in my other world as owner of Jackie's Ribs, I was president of Bones and Brew, and our charity for Bones and Brew is Abitine of Kurth, so I really do apologize.
Thanks again for the opportunity. Again, for the record, my name is Jean Farr. I work as the Senior Vice President of Developmental Disability Services at Albertina Kerr Centers. We are a 95-year-old nonprofit social service agency providing services to low-income children, families, youth at risk, and people with developmental disabilities. As Daryl said earlier, the issues that we talk about are those faced by all the organizations that provide services to people with disabilities. At Kerr, we provide residential services, 24-hour residential services, to about 120 people and about, daytime services and employment for about 100 people. I will briefly describe the challenges faced by our organization and then tell you about Tracy, who wanted to accompany me here today but was too ill to do so. As you're faced with staggering budget decisions, the staggering budget deficit, I know that you are looking everywhere for places to cut, and organizations like ours cannot sustain further erosion to our budgets and still provide the safe care that we do. At Kerr, we're in the process of putting our budget together right now, and we are facing a $175,000 increase in workers' compensation costs, a $50,000 increase in health insurance costs, and an at least $90,000 increase in general and professional liability. Utilities and gas continue to rise, and our fundraising efforts are yielding diminishing returns because of the incredible stock market hits that they've sustained. We've not received a cost of living adjustment for 3 years, and it looks highly unlikely that we're going to get one for the next biennium. Within the organization that I manage to deal with the crisis that this has caused, we have frozen all but direct care salaries. We've eliminated three administrative offices, reduced our vehicle fleet by 20%, eliminated two of five senior management positions, reduced direct line management by 40%,
Our program managers don't go to local grocery stores to shop. Instead, they use Winco certificates. And we don't buy gasoline from our gas stations. We go to a fuel man, commercial vendors. At this point, we cannot think of anything else to cut without compromising the health and safety of the people that we serve. At this time, we pay full health insurance coverage for our employees. And because of the fact that we can't pay them adequate wages, they can't even insure their families. To insure each family member, it would cost them an additional $600 to $900 a month. Health care is rising. All the things that are impacting us as an organization are also impacting the people that we employ. And it's a vicious cycle for the folks we serve, because the more that the wage issue impacts our employees, the harder it is to keep them. These folks leave and get higher paying jobs. And the human cost of this turnover is heartbreaking for the people that we serve. People who are medically fragile, like those that you met today, only people who live in group homes, depend upon their caregivers for their lives. Establishing trust in someone that has our life in their hands and tends to our most intimate needs is not an easy thing. But eventually people do develop an intimate familiarity with the people who bathe them and help them eat, administer their medicine, and help them in and out of their wheelchairs. Once they develop this trust and familiarity, then they're faced with people leaving. And they're facing a constant flow of strangers in and out of their homes. A person who, for instance, needs to be repositioned every couple hours may very well fall asleep before shift change and wake up to a complete stranger, moving their fragile body without the knowledge of the subtle differences, which would make that experience a whole lot less frightening. Every day in our system, someone is woken up, bathed, assisted, at the toilet by a complete stranger. I'm sure that you find that as tragic and unimaginable as I do. Let me briefly tell you about Tracy, whose picture you have before you. He has multiple disabilities. In addition to spina bifida, he has bradycardia, which is a heart condition that requires a pacemaker, constant monitoring, and has associated sleep apnea. Because of the severity of the sleep apnea, he requires a BiPAP machine with oxygen that assists him in breathing at night. Tracy also has a seizure disorder and a urostomy. He had hydrocephalus as a child, and because of that has a VP shunt, which drains excess fluid from his head. Years ago, he had a stroke and is paralyzed, so he only has the use of his left arm. As you can see by the picture in your packet, he has his own room, and he's been living in that home for about 9 years now. He has a very rich life. He has bird feeders outside of his window. He enjoys the animals around the property and gets a lot of incredible life enjoyment from having that, the option of living in his own home. Yep. He came from a nursing home about 9 years ago and still talks a lot about how difficult it was for him. Tracy, his housemates, and the roughly 4,000 people like him who receive excellent care in the community depend on their caregivers, and we in turn depend upon you to not, further erode our budget. And just implore you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, to please not balance a state budget on the backs of Oregon's most vulnerable citizens or the incredible people who provide their care. Thank you so much. And we'd be happy to answer any questions.
And please give my hellos to Chris.
I will do that.
Thank you. And I am going to try to get everyone in today, which means that everybody's going to have to stay late, because we are running about 30 minutes behind schedule. So with that, Bob Costanzo and Ellen Lowe, would you please come up, please? And on deck will be Jerry Smith and Gwyneth Van Frank Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Bob Castagna representing the Oregon Catholic Conference. I've handed you two documents, one an article entitled Common Good, Lives at Risk, from the April 14th, 2003 edition of America Magazine, and the other one was an article that appeared in yesterday's New York Times with a chart indicating that Oregon, on a percentage basis, is one of the five critical states in the nation in terms of the revenue shortfall that we face. The first article, Common Good, Lives at Risk, has an interesting history. I was at a meeting in Washington, D.C. in February explaining to one of the editors of this magazine the difficulties that our state was facing and was asked to write a microcosm, Oregon's picture, for this magazine. He was so taken by what I was telling him about the shortage of our revenue situation, the cutback in education dollars, human service dollars, that he wanted for their magazine to be able to provide a snapshot of what one of these revenue shortfalls in a state looked like. That resulted in this article, which was published last Monday. In the article, I suggest that one of the solutions is a new federal aid package for the states. And knowing of our shortfall estimated at $2.5 billion, I figured about $2 billion coming from the federal government would necessitate about a $200 billion federal aid package to the states. Well, I was struck in yesterday's New York Times by looking at, and if you look at the last page in that document, there's a chart of the states. And Oregon stands as one of the five most difficultly positioned states in the nation, with California, Nevada, Colorado, and Alaska. And that's a very interesting chart because of where it positions us nationally. And I took the co-chair's presentation of the budget to heart, particularly the statement that these are extraordinary times requiring extraordinary measures. And since the states are in the worst position that they've been since the end of World War II, wouldn't it seem incumbent upon the leadership at the state levels, be it at the gubernatorial level or at the legislative leadership level, to appeal to the federal government to help the states? Literally, from the title of the article that we chose for America, Common Good, Lives at Risk, and from the experiences that we're having in the communities, people's lives literally are at risk, and people are dying. We had the sad and tragic account that the Oregonian provided on April the 15th of the individual who had an epileptic seizure because of a lack of $13 a day worth of medication, resulting in more than $250,000 worth of medical bills. So some of these measures that we're making are winding up costing society much more in terms of public dollars and public resources than the dollars we would initially invest to try to secure that safety net for individuals. In writing the article, I surveyed Catholic Charities, St. Vincent de Paul, and you can see in that article the statistics in terms of the increases. The increases in the requests for assistance are staggering. So when we look at the budget that deals with seniors and people with disabilities, the medically needy program is essential. The general assistance program is essential. Oregon Project Independence, the provider reimbursement rates, the disability levels. These are all unconscionable cuts that we are making as a people. And when we look at what is going on at the level of the federal government in terms of the congressional debate, in terms of the hundreds of billions of dollars difference between a House-passed version of the budget reconciliation bill. They want $550 billion in tax cuts. The Senate wanted to keep it at $350 billion. The initial proposal was $726 billion. Doesn't it seem appropriate that at this time, when the states are in the most severe difficulty that they have confronted in nearly 60 years, that we should be making an appeal from this state together with other states, to the U.S. Congress, to the administration, to secure that safety net on the basis of providing for the common good and preserving people's lives? That literally is what is at stake. And for us to do something less than that, I think, is missing the mark in terms of what we are about as a people and what government's obligation is. Certainly families, community, churches, and charities have an obligation to provide for people in need. But government has an inescapable moral obligation to provide for those who can't provide for themselves. And on behalf of the Oregon Catholic Conference, that is my request to you who see these budgets and hear the plight of these people who testify, and I know you are quite moved by their testimony, but we have to be more than just moved. The bottom line is, can we preserve the lives of these people? Can we preserve the budgets that are necessary to secure that safety net? And that is our request to you today.
Mrs. Lowe.
Chair Winters and members of the committee, I'm Ellen Lowe, and I appear today as legislative advocate for the Oregon Food Bank and the Oregon Law Center. And I need to say that I'll be using a lot of acronyms today, and
I don't have Rosie up in front of you.
But I really do appreciate the contributions that are going to come to the Oregon Food Bank as a result of what you've been doing this session. I appear today to ask that you reject the policy package 091. That is the package that defunds general assistance. My mentor and late advocacy partner, Jerry Bieberly, always used to advise me to follow the money. Well, this last year I discovered that when assigned general funds disappear from a program, the program may also disappear, and that's general assistance. These are the folks that you heard just a little bit about yesterday. They can't have more than $50 to their in cash or cans to their name. No more than $1,500 in resources. They have to have a disability that would be at least 1 year in duration. They're unemployable. And as of February 1st, they also have no general assistance program. And so 2,373 folks are no longer receiving $314 a month. Now, we've often referred to the General Assistance Program as a general fund program, but in the last session, general assistance became part of that Medicare upper limit payment funded activity group, and this may account for its disappearance. What didn't appear in yesterday's budget presentation on general assistance was any mention of the Supplemental Security Income, or I'll use the acronym SSI from now on, recoveries that are returned to the state when the general assistance folks are certified for SSI. And I believe, according to information that I have received from the department, that $6,252,000 in SSI recoveries from this biennium's GA population will be coming to us. They'll accrue to the department this next biennium. $6,252,000. I should say that when Oregonians apply for general assistance, they have to sign a form saying that they'll apply for these federal benefits, and when they are awarded SSI, the state can then be reimbursed out of the SSI retroactive payment. You could characterize, in my judgment, the general assistance payments really as being sort of a float. And so I strongly encourage you to seek information from the department through their Benefit Exchange Information Network. Their Benefit Exchange Information Network. I believe you will be able to discover the incidence of these recoveries and their potential to assist this next biennium with general assistance funding. The 2001 legislature acknowledged that these folks really were at the bottom in terms of their resources and in terms of their disability. And so even though general assistance folks are not part of the federally categorically eligible folks for the Oregon Health Plan, you will recall, I hope, that they were included as part of the Oregon Health Plan Plus. And I would like to suggest that they need to be part of the plus as you do your budget also. I implore you to reinstate general assistance. Thank you so very much.
Thank you, Mrs. Lowe. And Jerry Smith and, let's see, who did I call it? Gwyneth. And also on deck then after that is Kathy Jennings. And I will ask everyone to keep their remarks to approximately 2 minutes. I have several other individuals who would like to testify, and we need to adjourn this meeting by 3:30. You're losing members because we have other committees to go to.
You want to talk about it?
Sure. Okay.
All right. I'm Gwyneth Van Frank Carlson. I'm from Eugene, Oregon on Bloomberg Road. And today I'm wearing many hats. I'm a business owner with my husband. We own a construction company. We're also landlords of rental property. And we have children in the public school system. So I have many concerns about what's going on. I'm here to, I'm also on the Lane Independent Living Alliance board. And as such, we are working on a voter registration project to register to vote as many of the 30.4% of Oregonians who have disabilities, according to the Oregon Office on Disability and Health. That's 30.4%, one-third almost, of the entire state of Oregon has declared themselves as having some level of significant disability. That's a very large block of people. That doesn't include families and friends and service providers. So we are working to register voters. I also am here to talk about two people that I know briefly who've been impacted. One is a woman who has been working all her life, received 2 hours a day in home care services, and was terrified of her vulnerability to the loss of those services and her becoming homeless. So she took good care of herself. She had a stroke. And now she has gone through 3 months, 3 weeks in the ICU, 3 months in a nursing home, and has lost her home, is living in residential care, and is now well below level 10 and will not lose services. And she also lost her lucidity. She's not here to speak for herself. Another man who, as
I love your testimony, but I have, it's 20, it's 12 after, okay. And I have about 10 other individuals who would like to speak.
I won't tell you the story of the person, but I will tell you in general, the medically needy program represents people who have worked for many, many years and paid taxes. Those are the people that are being cut. So it's I encourage you to find ways to fill those tax expenditure holes. And as the Revenue Coalition has suggested, rather than further cuts in programs. Thank you.
Jerry.
Yes. I'm Jerry Smith, 67-year-old veteran, retired social worker from Eugene. I'm going to skip a lot of what's been said today because it was said very well about how well managed the health and welfare benefits to children, adults, and seniors were, and that this kind of care has saved the state in the past many hundreds of millions of dollars by preventing deterioration. Out front of this building, on the front steps, we read that 750 American and coalition casualties in Iraq and 6,875 Iraqi civilian casualties were there, a total of approximately 7,500 casualties in Iraq. Oregon, however, has an estimated 100,000 casualties of low-income disabled person needing medical care that have already been cut off in the ongoing seven sessions of this legislature. A conservative death estimate would be about 10,000 Oregonians. This session targets another 150,000 more disabled persons to be cut from needed medical care. An estimate would be about 15,000 more dead Oregonians. Oregon's health and welfare labor infrastructure is destroyed by these cuts, as thousands of home care aides and unknown hundreds of or thousands of skilled professionals are fired. The costs are already amounting as cut-off medically needy disabled persons have already deteriorated. There are no records of the deaths or of other traumas of persons on closed cases. Oregon's economy is hurt by the statewide collapse of these health and welfare systems. To save the state a dime, we lose 90 cents of federal money participation on these cuts, state cuts. I urge you to fund the money by ending tax exclusions for the rich who own second homes and yachts and have these as write-offs. I hope that you will really save Oregon's systems.
Thank you. Kathy Dennis and David Baker.
Kathy Janess is in a wheelchair in the other room,
I believe. Oh, she's in the other room. Well, when she comes in, I will call her. David Baker and Ben, is it Ori? Go ahead, Mr. Baker.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me to testify here today. My name is David Baker. I'm the Outreach Director for Survivors Advocating for an Effective System. SAFES, as our acronym spells out, is a four-year-old organization that empowers crime survivors to work toward effective restorative criminal justice. As survivors of crime, we understand that many people find themselves vulnerable to victimization due to their disability, and others, like our executive director, Arwin Byrd, have been left with permanent disabilities as a result of crimes perpetrated upon them. As individuals and as an organization, then, we have a vested interest in and vital need for adequately funded services for those with disabilities. You heard Gwyneth mention that 30% of Oregonians live with a disability. What's even more overwhelming is that two-thirds of those individuals cannot find work. SAFE believes it is important, therefore, that Oregon have a safety net for those citizens who are still most at risk for poverty, unemployment, lack of access to health care, lack of affordable and accessible housing, and lack of accessible transportation. The reality is that people living in poverty are twice as likely to be victimized by crime. So ask yourselves as you consider the budget and all of the very tough, unenviable choices you face, what effect will cutting programs further have on people's lives? We urge you to place in the forefront of your minds the concrete realities facing people with fixed incomes, disabilities, or both. Many of the people served by the programs funded under this Seniors and Persons with Disabilities budget are struggling to gain social, political, and economic equity. Considering the link between income level and crime victimization, and please remember that people living at or near the poverty line are twice as likely to be victimized, it becomes clear that the role of programs and services in helping to address these hurdles is indispensable. It is also clear to us that cuts to programs have a direct and irrefutable impact on the safety and well-being of your constituents. Dismantling the budget for these programs, even with the best money-saving intentions, would be tantamount to impeding the lives of persons with disabilities. And it bears mentioning at this point that despite deep cuts to social services, programs, and education, the legislature still finds itself facing a budget shortfall. SAFES encourages the members of the Ways and Means Committee to consider seriously the recommendations made by the Oregon Revenue Coalition, of which SAFES is a member, and look harder for foregone revenue in the state's convoluted system of 350 tax breaks. While we're busy writing checks out of the state treasury to finance second homes for millionaires, people are losing services, hope, and in some cases, lives, due to draconian cuts. Please don't put any more programs on the chopping block. because the $400 million ending balance you seek is in sight. Simply by capping tax credits at 33 cents on the dollar would return an estimated $1.7 billion to the state's coffers, and this comes from the Oregon Revenue Coalition. It's time to stop seeing programs as budget busters and instead recognize them for what they truly are: investment in Oregon's livability and lifelines for our most vulnerable and valuable residents. I thank you for your time and for extending the time of this committee.
Mr. Baker, have you provided testimony to the House Revenue Committee?
That's next on my list.
Because this committee doesn't provide the vehicle for your comments that you made, and the appropriate committee is the House Revenue Committee.
We just want to be sure to weigh in here and recognize the link between poverty and victimization, and we also understand that many people who are crime survivors because of a disability or have been left with disabilities as a result. This does affect our constituency, and that's why we're here today, Madam Chair.
I've met the person who has led the charge on not only this issue, but the repeal of Measure 11 and some other crime issues. So she's been in this building for a couple sessions that I know of. But thank you for bringing your testimony forward. Ben,
thank you very much.
Is it Ori? If not, Ed Johnston, Velma, is it Hartwig? And then the next person behind that is Betty Brislon.
Yes. Good afternoon. My name is Edward Johnson from Lincoln County. I have, in the last couple weeks, put a package in each one of your hands dealing with my medical condition. I was one of those bouncers at a nightclub that was injured because of a pipe crushed in my neck and skull. And it's been thoroughly frustrating because I not only had private insurance at the time, when I became injured, that was canceled. Dealing with general assistance, that program needs to exist because I believe instead of 20 administrators, we need 2,775 people getting general assistance and 20 administrators. If you're going to stimulate the economy, let's be realistic. The administrators will not stimulate the economy. The poor who get general assistance will stimulate the economy by paying water and electricity bills more than administrators. Without that, the electric company is going to go to you, as well as the rest of us, and raise our rates another 25% to justify that loss. So I'm not an economist, but let's be realistic. I mean, we can see the writing on the wall. The other thing I have dealing with the packet that I gave you is dealing with a psychological report, dealing with how the state pays psychiatrists an exorbitant amount of money to make falsification information on people. Now, everything I have stated and has been verified, proved fact. I had a psychologist say dealing with my neck and head injury was delusions of grandeur. Well, as I've testified many times on the Senate floor here this Senate session and last several, that I did have a disc lodged in my spinal cord. About 2 weeks after that, the psychological report came out that disabilities office paid for, I went in 2 months later for spinal surgery to get the disc out because it was actually killing me. It was cutting in my spinal cord. So when it comes to psychologists, I have no faith in their reports. And psychology was never introduced until 1969 to a New York court when it was finally accepted. And I think we still need to question reverse psychology theories. Because I believe me, in this report, it's not totally accurate. The one thing is, yes, the first job I did have was 5.5 years old. Can be verified even by my own mother. My father left, so I had to pick up the means to start to work very young to take the means of my father and help pay the bills until I was a teenager when I started my own business, and I know what it was like paying taxes at a young age as a teenager starting his own business and dealing with raising without a father. I took the responsibility to help my mother out, my brothers and sisters. So when we look at past psychologists or past reports, when people say that kids did this, yeah, it's a reality because I'm one of those who have done it. Not only that, I have taken care of relatives of mine who have had strokes. I'm going
to
wrap it up real quick.
Yep.
But I know what it's like to help take care of families who have had medical needs. Now I'm in a point where I'm trying to save myself from being either quadriplegic or in a wheelchair. And what disturbs me as I was a disabled worker and victim of a crime, when it really comes down to it, But, you know, that's immaterialistic when it comes down to it. The bottom line is we need to take care of our people and quit giving money to foreign immigrants that come into this country, and we need to take care of our own people first. Until we do that, we cannot help anybody else. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnston. Velma Hartwig.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Velma Hartwig. I'm from Lincoln County. I'm going to keep it very brief. I just wanted to let you know that as a private citizen, not involved with any agency, that the people of this state support giving assistance, medical assistance, and home care assistance to people. People are willing to do without other things in order to do this because our hearts go out to them. And we really admire this committee for digging into this and hearing what people have to say. I'm not going to repeat stories that I could tell you about. But I think one thing we need to do is to make sure that the agencies are held accountable, because there are a lot of wastes in many of the agencies, as many of you probably know. And thank you very much.
Thank you. From you came from Lincoln County.
Lincoln County.
Thank you for coming and testifying. Betty Brislon, is Betty here? Marcia Kelly, did Marcia get tired and leave? I think maybe we tired everybody else out, and if there's no other anybody else who wants to make comments or remarks, you want to come up here to the and put your name for the record.
I'm Jerry Smith from Eugene. I testified earlier.
You was already talking.
Yes. Kathy Janess and Ellen, who were both going to testify, came to from Eugene to Salem by train. It's the only accessible route for people and quadriplegics in wheelchairs. And the train has left, so they had to get transportation back there. And they're not going to be able to testify, but they're, of course, opposed to cuts.
Would you give them a message? Because the next time if anyone comes to the Capitol, and a couple things we ask, if they are coming from long distance, particularly although Eugene is not more than 100 miles, but if there's special consideration, if you let us know, we will try to take them first. You know, we always like to accommodate individuals who come here, who take the time to come to testify. I mean, after all, this is your capital. So if you give them that message for me, that I do appreciate them coming, I'm sorry that they did not have the opportunity. But should they come back again, please let us know if there's special arrangements, like they had to catch their train and what have you. Would you do that for me, Jerry?
I will give them that message, Chairman Winters, and thank you very much.
Thank you. And with that, we are adjourned till tomorrow at 1 o'clock.
Yes.
Yes. No. Yes, we are. We're adjourned till tomorrow at 1 o'clock.